Hello and welcome back to Everyday Oral Surgery. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. I'm an oral maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver, Colorado, and I really appreciate you tuning into the episode today. Thanks to all those who have emailed and texted me ideas about topics for the podcast or guests they want to hear from. If you would like to be a guest on the show or know someone you'd like to hear from, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com. Also, please visit our website, everydayoralsurgery.com, if you'd like to search the podcast in an easier way by topic. We'd like to hear from everyone and really appreciate you guys listening. Keep in mind that everything we're discussing here is based on personal experience and opinions, so please supplement everything you're learning here with approved research studies. Without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. Okay, welcome to another episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. Today I'm with Dr. Eric Holmgren. He's an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in the New England area. Eric, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, this is great. I'm super excited to talk to you a little bit. I know you have a diverse background and you've kind of done a lot of different things in your career, but can you give us just a brief history of your training and your kind of current practice setup?
Yeah, for sure. I currently work at Dartmouth as an employee with the otolaryngology department and the surgery department as an oral maxillofacial surgeon. And I've been working there for the last past 5 years. I took sort of a fortuitous route in terms of, you know, coming out of residency, and I was in private practice for about 14 years prior to diving into academic environment. I did my dental school in Philadelphia and then did my oral surgery training and medical school at Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland. And I know you had past guests, Brian Bell and David Hirsch, and I was of that era when Brian was a fellow and David was a fellow. So I know them quite well and just awe-inspired at their career trajectory and just really influenced by their path. So it's really cool to know them and be part of their training as well.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, after my oral surgery training, really didn't know what to do. My chief year was quite, you know, interesting and perplexing. And, you know, I had a couple of baby girls that were pretty young, and my wife was a German professor, and we were kind of thinking, oh, how do we balance this? And she's like, heck no, I'm just going to hang with the kids for a while and then we'll figure it out maybe in a year or two. And I really always thought I wanted to do an academic position. I remember interviewing as a dental student for oral surgery programs, and, you know, they always like, especially Dr. Dirks, who I trained with in Oregon, you know, he was always pro people going into academics. You know, that was a real, and I always, you know, enjoyed research. I mean, I had my master's degree in engineering and had some research background, and thought that balancing teaching and surgery and research was always something I would do. And then, I don't know, something happened where I just felt like this urge to take care of this little family, you know, support them, have time with them. And I just really, my security gland kind of took over, and I'm like, okay, well, I got all this debt. I got these little babies and I need to put shoes on them and feed them. And I'm like, oh, I just got to take a job and I'll deal with those ambitions later. So that was a real driving force for me in choosing my path. And my wife had grown up in Vermont, and there was practice in the, you know, Berkshires, kind of New England area. And it just seemed like a good fit, and it really kind of padded my security gland.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, just a couple of years. And then 14 years later, I made a change, you know? So it was interesting how that thought process happened. And like I said, I just felt a real desire to provide a nice, comfortable, secure living for my family. But at the same time, in the background, there was constant personal struggle as to, you know, finding ways to utilize all the training I did. I mean, I did a lot, you know, we do a lot of training, you know, and in a small rural private practice where you're doing exodontia, which is challenging in itself, you know, balancing in office anesthesia, expectations of the local referral dentists, providing care for, and you know, for the community, taking care of what all the community offers here in terms of needing rural care and not having utilization of a tertiary care center to manage complex things. You know, the challenge was there, but the volume and frequency was not enough to support feeling like my skills and confidence were eroding, you know?
Yeah.
So that was always in the background from like day one. And I, reached a few points in my career where I needed to really tackle that. I couldn't turn the noise down on that.
Okay. So you got your family kind of stable, and I mean, was it after you kind of felt like, hey, we're financially secure, now I can kind of delve into some of these other things and go back to doing certain procedures and types of oral surgery?
Yeah, I think, you know, financial fitness was always, you know, something that was, I valued, and being smart about things and creating a nice solid financial base. But, you know, it's funny in retrospect that if I had gone into an academic career right away and not sort of thought that academics was just more like a volunteer position that you barely made ends meet, you know, like there's that, at least back in early 2000s, you know, that was the, you know, the thought process I thought, you know. So I feel like what I had thought, you know, the disparity between private practice and academics, I thought was a real thing at that time. And now that I've had the hindsight of being in academic environment, you know, the income disparity is nowhere near what I thought, you know. I'm surprised how well, you know, I've been able to do in academic practice relative to private practice income. So I think that was a huge, so once I felt like I had a good cushion, which happened quite quick, you know, all the debt was off, everything, you know, then you start piling on, you know, things that you feel like you need, like big old house that you got to build and all this stuff. And then you're like, whoa, wait a minute, let's rearrange our priorities, because I'm not sure how long I want to do this. And then we really got down to, you know, nitty gritty in terms of sort of controlling how much we were in debt and how much we were anchored into the practice. So, and into the environment, so that we could potentially make a move. But that in itself sort of came with its own stress, you know, like if you grow where you're planted, you know, I feel like there's some value in that. Like, okay, I'm not leaving here. We're staying here. You have to grow where you're planted. Where I always felt like I was kind of one foot out and looking for something better. So that created, some stress, even though we were financially more fit.
Yeah, I definitely can relate to what you're saying there. I think a lot of us have that.
Yeah.
Anxiety and feel like there's always something better, and
yeah,
you know, I should always kind of keep my foot halfway out the door just in case. And
yeah,
sometimes you feel like you can miss the boat maybe if you don't commit to where you're at, but then yeah, maybe you'd miss an opportunity by getting too entrenched in your lifestyle.
Yeah, and you know what ended up making me feel comfortable with that, is a little more comfortable, is that I felt like I maxed out everything I could do personally and professionally. And I then was at a plateau in terms of growth. You know, I felt like there was no growth potential. And I felt comfortable once I reached growth potential, or reached my maximum in terms of what I could do income-wise, professionally, you know, my kids were a certain age where I felt like they had really had a solid, you know, foundation growing up, that it was like, okay, now I felt like I can need to take on another challenge and, you know, start on a new journey. It also kind of correlated that transition, although it was a long transition, that transition correlated with having some medical issues that were quite surprising. I had, you know, my early 40s had like a heart issue that had blood clots in my coronary arteries for some random reason, and had to have some stents, and that really sort of put a light on to like, wow, life is short, and I have to sometimes prioritize myself and not everyone else, and I really feel, you know, my career, my like preparation of what I've done sort of defines who I am in a sense. And so I really needed to find something that I wanted to do for myself, which always harked back to being in some academic environment, collegial environment that engulfed sort of more complicated cases. And I kind of wanted to go to bed really thinking about a case, you know, like in residency, you know, when you're like, oh my God, I'm doing my first LaFord and I've never done those before. And I've read all these chapters and I still don't know what I'm doing. I don't understand what I'm reading. And I hope it's going to work out for the patient because I've developed a bond with them. And, you know, so I wanted more of that. I kind of wanted that residency feeling of some growth and challenge and felt like you're really caring for patients in need. And for me, the academic environment, you know, harnessed that quite a bit. And so that medical issue, financial stability, the feeling that I have peaked in terms of professional growth where I was sort of started the process of transition for me to an academic practice.
So you went the 14 years kind of doing, I assume, bread and butter private practice, and then you made that switch. You know, how did you start, I guess, relearn stuff and get into that uncomfortable environment?
Well, what was great is the transition was a little murky. I have one of my co-residents and someone I knew who was a past fellow at Oregon run the UCSF Fresno program, which is, by the way, a little shout out to that program, is really good program.
Nice.
And man, they kill it out there and just great attendings, Brian Wu and Bob Julian, who run that program. They just do everything, you know, probably one of the busiest programs in California. And I had reached out to them about, hey, I'm thinking about, you know, going an academic position. And they said, hey, why don't you come out and cover for us when we go to the Amos meeting? Because they have, you know, they were real lean on faculty and people who they thought they could maybe handle some of the complexities. And I don't know if they thought that I could, but they just needed a warm body to maybe supervise the residents in clinic and maybe the OR. And I'm like, okay, that'd be a good challenge. And I think I can do that. And so I used to go out there for a couple weeks a year when they went to the Amos meeting or on vacations and would fill in as quasi attending. And that's where I felt like I really needed to step in. Can I handle this? Because we were doing gunshot wounds, LaFort threes, you know, infections, you know, just really complicated, you know, stuff. And it all kind of came back from residency, like, yeah, I still got this. I feel like I can do it. I think I'm doing an okay job. And at least Brian and Bob didn't say, Eric, what did you do? We got a ton of complications, you know? Yeah. So that didn't happen. So I thought, or maybe it didn't, they didn't tell me, but so that was kind of build my confidence a little bit. You know, my wife and kids are pretty rooted here in New England area. So, you know, moving out there and joining other programs. So dipping my toe in the water and slowly building my confidence. And then with my private practice, you know, maybe not referring out a few things and trying, you know, to tackle challenging things that I would normally maybe refer out to tertiary care centers hours away, which typically didn't do, but I would take on a few more things. And I think that was helpful in building my confidence.
Nice.
The skills were still there.
Oh, that's awesome. So you started getting into that, and then where else did you go from there? Sounds like you got pretty busy over the following years.
Yeah, and so I did a transition. I looked in because family wasn't really willing or to move, and I wasn't really pushing that. So I kind of drew a radius of where I felt I could go.
Okay.
And I had some connections at Dartmouth, and it was a place where I felt, I don't know, it just worked out. It wasn't that long of a commute, and it was a nice area, and it had some opportunities to, you know, grow something. And I was presented with opportunity to fill in and take over a single OMS, Dr. Adante, who was there for 40 plus years, who was on the brink of retirement, and an opportunity to maybe take a private practice bent to the clinic. and also just support him and his patients and the ENT residency they had, in terms of they needed someone to do all of the facial trauma for their group. Not necessarily they needed it, but they wanted it because it was challenging for everyone who's so subspecialized to sort of, oh, take on facial trauma, and it would be a real burden and something I have, you know, was really interested in. So I went up there kind of as a way to transition into the academic realm and also, you know, grow a little section of the surgery department. And I think the private practice exposures was really helpful because of, you know, patient volume, flow of, you know, getting patients in and out of clinic, doing kind of high volume exodontia, which is something, you know, as an oral surgeon, I don't know, it is who we are, right? We need to, you know, it was funny. I remember going on an interview for residency and, you know, sexy topics with head and neck cancer and cleft and craniofacial stuff and all the expanded scope stuff we do. But there's something about, you know, putting a needle in someone's arm, putting them to sleep and taking a tooth out, and which kind of defines us. And so I really kind of grew some, you know, just high volume exodontia as a way of bringing revenue in and showing the hospital like, yeah, you know, we can make this profitable. And as a result, you know, you can invest in us and in my little sector if we can not be in the red all the time. And hence, you know, getting a physician assistant, nurse, getting some human capital, getting some, you know, investment in the department was helpful. And I think the, you know, exodontia component was really helpful in that. And so, you know, I grew that, and then taking on a lot of the complicated tertiary care referrals, you know, with trauma and, you know, pathology and some of the, you know, medically compromised patients there that get referred was, you know, something that was all, you know, built up and needed to be taken care of.
I have to ask you real quick, because when you say you brought that private practice perspective and maybe it, you know, made things more efficient, streamlined in your clinic. Do most, and I don't even know if you know the answer to this, but do most oral surgery, like department chair people, directors, professors, do they get any type of financial reward from, you know, creating a clinic that's more productive? Or what is the incentive? Because it seems like some programs, the one I came from was very, very, you know, highly motivated for one reason or another to have a super efficient, productive clinic, but others seem very cavalier and act like their, you know, their clinic is like, whatever, who cares how many people we see or how much we do, it doesn't really matter. And so that's always confused me. Do you know the answer to that?
Yeah. And I do think it has to do with revenue and the setup of the reimbursement system. So I know in the department, so the chair of the departments, you know, typically get a 15% cut of your production, which goes into the, you know, the health of the department and growth of the department, which I think maybe personally is benefited from the chair. So it kind of kicks up the ladder.
Okay.
And it depends on, you know, the structure of the administration of a particular hospital or dental school. So unfortunately, there's a lot of motivation for people under them to be productive. So I think that plays a huge role.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it, you know, if they're getting kicked up a little bit and also, you know, being efficient, then you're going to retain employees or surgeons who are busy and who are reaping the benefits of being busy, which is that private practice sense. Like if you sit around and don't do anything and you've got all this overhead, you're never going to survive.
Right.
So that environment, I think, is really, I've noticed, at least in my academic center, is sort of similar in that realm, as opposed to being, you know, fixed salary where there's no production incentive. So I think having some production incentive really drives that.
Nice. Okay. Let's see. You were doing lectures. You were mentioning too before that you also were involved with performing research for the School of Engineering, or what kind of role did you play with that?
Yeah, that was a big reason why I also chose or considered Dartmouth, was they had a lot of collaboration with, you know, the college and the medical school.
Okay.
So, you know, in terms of a typical academic job, you know, you have the clinical realm, you have the service realm, service including sort of teaching and committees and being involved in those types of things. And then you have the research arm of everything to really round out, you know, why you're in an academic setting. And so I felt like I needed to have, you know, my hands in all three of those things. Now, obviously the clinical thing, being the only guy there, really the only OMFS, although Dr. Dante thankfully is still around and helps me out a ton. I think that that clinical realm really skews things. But what's nice is about the engineering, I guess the whole thing was, you know, utilizing your full training. You know, so I was an engineer before I started all this, and I always felt like I put so much effort into that. And I'd love to, you know, continue research. So making some connections with engineering professors there, just sort of clinically thinking of problems that frustrate me. Like in particular, like ankle fractures have always been something challenging for me. You know, the morphology of the mandibular angle on people is so varying, you know, and throwing a chompy plate on someone with like a narrow external oblique ridge and a real thin ascending ramus. And, you know, how is that even working? Why not just throw a lateral border plate on there? You got that smooth surface. And so I always thought like the morphology is so different. And so how can we, you know, from an engineering standpoint, really look at that? And so all these, and it's so easy. You just sort of like talk to them like, whoa, okay, that's an engineering problem. And so I've got some other projects in mind like that. And just having that collaboration for some, you know, translational research projects really is super fun. I enjoy that a lot. And when I feel like, you know, as you're practicing, you know, good research projects are things that frustrate the heck out of you, that you tend to shy away from. And once you start thinking about it and sort of framing a research project around that frustration, you actually start to like the problem. Like, great, I want to see that patient, you know, with that problem, because I think I want to, you know, solve it. So the engineering resources I have, and also the connections are really fun, and we've got some, you know, neat things going on there. The other thing, which I've started to, you know, as I was transitioning from the private practice to academics, was forcibly putting myself into uncomfortable situations. You know, granted, I'm doing that clinically with reservation, of course, you know, patient safety, not doing things that I'm not trained to or have the background or knowledge, but taking that on, like growing my orthognathic practice, taking on, you know, jaw in a day stuff with plastic surgeons that I'm working with. But the other thing is sort of like the teaching arm is putting myself into challenging things. Like I got an email like 5 years ago, like, hey, we need medical student coaches. And I'm like, okay, let's do that. And so that has been super challenging and fun growing as like a student coach, basically working with medical students to get them through this process of being a medical student, from transitioning to school, book learning, to clinical learning, to getting ready to be a resident and to be kind of a happy doctor. That has been super challenging for me to grow that skill. And then, you know, doing a couple other teaching things. And I feel like that has just helped me grow as a person and really feel like I've kind of tackled the interest I've had in academics and my personal growth.
Oh, that's awesome. And then you have to mention you did some role or have done some role with sports medicine. Is that correct?
I've always, when I was in private practice, I've been doing that for maybe since 2010, 10, 12 years. I have some good buddies who are orthopedic surgeons here at the local college, Williams College. And the athletic trainers would always call me about, you know, some head and neck stuff with their college athletes. And they asked me to start covering some games, some hockey games, because there's a mandate that you need to cover hockey, lacrosse, and football. And you need a sideline doc there. And so I've always done that. And I figured, well, can I be a sideline doc? You know, and so I called OMSNIC and I'm like, hey, can I suture extremities and maybe do some general triage, medical triage. And they're like, well, do you have your medical degree? I'm like, yeah, yeah, you can do that. We covered that sideline doc stuff. And I was surprised at that. So I was like, okay. And the college also gave me some liability, I think, for that. But just having I'm like, you know, but I'm not really, you know, I have my MD, but I did a year of general surgery, but I don't have like a whatever MD accredited specialty. But so apparently you can do that. And I think you can also, and you could look state by state, you can supervise athletic trainers as a dentist as well, I believe. So if anyone's interested in sideline doc stuff, I wouldn't let not having your medical degree be a hinder. So you may want to look. So basically what you're doing is you're supervising the athletic trainers and then providing triage for student athletes who may need to go to the ER or may need to just follow up with their student health center, or if they have some acute injury, suturing or bandaging, or just assisting the athletic trainers, who are super smart, by the way. So it's not like I'm doing a lot of heavy lifting. They're making a lot of decisions and I'm kind of supporting that or helping. So I had gotten into a few situations by myself, like at a hockey game where I've had to go on the ice, people were concussed and I had to take off some helmets and C-spine precautions and, you know, big games. I'm like, whoa, this is pretty cool. It's really fun watching watching D3 hockey, not very fun, right?
Yeah.
But when you're watching D3 hockey, where you actually have some responsibility for the athletes in terms of their care and their well-being, you have to be engaged. So you have to watch, you have to be really attentive, you know, making sure, see what kind of injuries happening and just being involved and being, you know, seeing the athletes in between each period or addressing the concerns of athletic trainers. So I then got pretty excited about that and just Googled. I was watching a show and someone said, you know, I kind of like watching MMA, and there was some show and like, yeah, I talked to my ringside physician who fixed my cauliflower ear or something. And I'm like, what's a ringside physician? So I Googled that. And apparently there's a whole association for ringside physicians, and you don't have to be any particular specialty. Like, there's some Vegas dermatologists who do a lot of MMA stuff, you know, like neurologists, ED docs, family docs, general surgeons, plastic surgeons, every kind of specialty. You just have to have, you have to have a medical license to do ringside physician work. And so I applied for the Massachusetts State Athletic Commission, and they were like, oh my gosh, thank goodness. We need someone like you, you know, who can maybe address a lot of the facial needs, but also has the chops to deal with like general medical sports related stuff. And I'm like, yeah, that's great. And so I've been doing that for, I think, almost 7 years now. And I had the fortunate thing of doing a couple big UFC fights at the Boston Garden, which are really cool, seeing some really big names and being on television and meeting Dana White and, you know, all those sort of things. And I tell you, just the highlight, you know, I get paid like 2 cents to do it. But it was, you know, but the ringside action and just being part of all of that is really cool. Unfortunately, I don't have a lot of time right now to do that, but it's really, really kind of fun side gig. And people should look into that, because I think one of the things that I've enjoyed, even though I'm not in a traditional OMFS department, so I'm like, it's me in an ENT department and I work with medical students, but I really feel the honor of representing our specialty as someone who is just representing our specialty. Cause then they go, wow, OMFS. Okay. We really need OMFS, and they can really help in this way. And their expertise is so valuable. You know, I think the ENT residents, staff, medical students really appreciate when I can kind of geek out on a mandible and get good results and look at occlusion and take care of frontal sinuses and orbits as well, you know. And I think just solidifying that, and I hope to grow our department and welcome anyone who's interested in, because we are really pretty busy. So anyone can reach out to me. But and then also in the realm of sports medicine, you know, who would you want on an island with you? Would you want someone who was trained in dentistry and medicine and anesthesia and general surgery? Probably, right?
Oh, of course.
So I would say I would choose an OMFS guy or gal to if I God forbid was on an island and needed, you know, and say you had all the medical equipment necessary to do spinals and procedures, and I don't know. I just feel like we're so well trained compared to, you know, the other specialties I see. So I feel like just being a representative in these different realms is, I don't know, has value, I guess.
Oh, for sure. And then on top of all that, if that weren't enough, you are doing some mission trips. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think this was all part of, you know, the sports medicine stuff, the, you know, UCSF Fresno stuff. And then the mission work was also that way of like putting myself in situations that you're uncomfortable as a way of growing personally, growing your, challenging your skills, and then taking it. And I kind of wanted to build all that as I went into potentially an academic job. So I was pretty inspired by, I know you asked quotes at the end of this. So yes. I apologize for not being spontaneous, but there is a surgeon, an English neurosurgeon, Henry Marsh. If you don't know him, you should, he's got a really pretty cool movie documentary and he's got some cool books. And I just, kind of fascinated. There's a lot of neurosurgery authors who write about great stuff. And he did trips to Ukraine. And I just got inspired about, you know, needing going abroad and taking, you know, my skill and applying it.
Okay.
You know, I guess that's one thing I tell, you know, students is that, you know, what an honor to develop a skill that you can go anywhere in the world and apply it.
Yeah.
It's really hard to go to rural Kenya and, although maybe I take that back, I was going to use IT or something, but, or, you know, marketing or communications. But if you, as a doctor, you can go anywhere at any time, your services will be needed. You can apply those skills. And I really wanted to test that because I always felt that was one of the reasons why I went into this. So I've been to Kenya. I'm going next month and, you know, Western Kenya, and I've gone to Guatemala several times and, you know, operating in environments where you have nothing and taking on challenging things, clinical scenarios is another skill building thing. And also just the sense of helping someone abroad who otherwise would not have the access to anybody. It's quite rewarding. I took my family. I always take my family on these trips as a way of vacationing, but also having them see some of the things that other people are doing and sort of appreciating the way other people live. You know, I'm not really into it to expose them to quote unquote poverty, because, you know, people in third world countries are, you know, I find like super happy most of the time. And,
oh yeah.
You know, it's also maybe a way of calibrating, like, you know, what do I really need to be happy? What do I really need in my life to find value? And I think exposing, you know, your kids to environments that are just, you know, different than how we run, I find super valuable. And then also just, you know, a lot of the things we do in the hospital, do you really need all this stuff? And becoming more efficient and mindful of what you need in the operating room. I don't know. It's been fantastic to do stuff like that.
That's cool. Yeah, really, really cool that you're getting out and doing that. Just as a side note, I just got back from Amos yesterday.
Oh, cool.
There's this Dr. Tim Bartholomew. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he gave this crazy lecture about doing surgeries somewhere in Africa. I think it's in the Congo, but it's like you're saying, he's like doing surgeries with, like, he's like MacGyver, you know, just like,
yeah,
just rigging up stuff from nothing and like doing these incredible surgeries.
Yeah.
Pretty remarkable what you can do with a small amount of supplies.
You know, most of the time, sometimes hard to found intubate patients. So we're using ketamine. You know, I'll just be taking out peel pack screws and plates and, you know, figuring it out. But yeah, it's super interesting what you can actually get away with, but it's really anxiety provoking leading up to a surgery where you're like,
yeah,
okay, I'm responsible for the materials, the setup, the sterility of all of this stuff? And, you know, am I really providing the best care for this patient? And regardless, you know, you still have to, you know, your standards still always have to be high, regardless of where you are. And
right.
Yeah, that is super anxiety provoking. But again, like, what an opportunity for growth, you know, to challenge yourself and really have, you know, think about what you're really doing. And I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been good. I hope to continue to do that indefinitely.
That's cool. Well, good. That's pretty remarkable that you've been able to get involved in all these different things and kind of switch gears and, you know, mid-career. I just relate with a lot of what you're saying. So pretty cool that have done that and got out of your comfort zone, learn new stuff. And I certainly feel the same, that when I kind of get out of my comfort zone and try something new and maybe take a new course, it's just so much more mentally stimulating than doing, you know, what you've been doing for years and years. It's cool to make a change sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. And I think everyone should do that. I mean, there's when you get into something, there's a tendency to move to, I'm just going to leave. This is not working. But then, like, to saddle in a little bit, you know, give yourself 5 years to saddle in. And then, but giving yourself also self your permission, like, look, I really grew this. I put a great effort into what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I've sort of professionally grown. I've served my community. I've taken the community I'm in. I've helped in many ways of seeing all patient mix. I've been involved in the hospital. I've taken on challenging cases. I've done volunteer work. I've served my community and I've served my referrals very well and honestly. But then giving yourself permission when you feel like you've maxed out in your growth, giving yourself permission to take on a new challenge is okay. You know, you're not leaving because it's bad. You're leaving because you've put a good effort in and you've served your community and they've gained some value from it. And it's okay to take, you know, some personal growth and do something different. And I felt like giving myself permission to do that was hard. It took a while, but I'm glad I made that move.
Yeah. I also love all the different things you've gotten involved in, just show the variety and the kind of the scope of different things, the spectrum that our profession can provide, you know, a doctor. It's awesome. What a great thing.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks.
Yeah. All right. We end every podcast with some rapid fire questions. So if you're ready, I'll hit you with the questions here.
Nice.
First one is, what is a non-oral surgery thing you do in your life that kind of helps you with your daily oral surgery skills?
I have three teenage daughters and my life after work is just involved with doing their stuff.
Okay.
And we travel a lot. But so I would say, like, out of work, I'm just in that tornado of teenagedom and what that involves. It just sort of exhausts me. But I would say, you know, we're exercising. I mean, I don't exercise as much as I want to, but like training, like not just exercising, but training. I feel like with all of the stuff we do from an ergonomic standpoint and how hard our job is and physically demanding our job is, especially with the repetitive nature of what we do, an exodontia and high volume stuff, you have to train just like a professional athlete. So really focus on your training for back strength, hip strength, shoulder strength, and being real intentional about that. So I've tried, I mean, I can get better, but training, so physical training, at least an hour every every 3 to 4 days a week of some focused training is huge for longevity, because I'm just amazed at some of the guys here in their mid 70s, just killing it, you know, with their ability. I mean, not that you may want to do it, but the ability to work as long as you can, even if it's in just an exodontia, can be so valuable later on. And so having the physicality to do that, I feel is important. So like training for your job.
I like that.
So I do, besides the teenage world, I'm training.
Okay. And is there something within the teenage realm that helps you, the way you help solve your daughter's problems? Is that related at all to oral surgery?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, they, like taking on a mission trip. So they kind of like, oh, all right, wow, I've got it pretty good. And
yeah,
wow, I really like helping people. My youngest daughter, I'll never forget, you know, she likes to stay busy on some of these trips. And I'm like, Mia, why do you do that? And she's like, Dad, I just like being helpful, you know? And I feel like, you know, that just helping develop their character and their values. Mm-hmm. And some of the things I've told my medical students, we have, you know, these lectures on character and values and kind of what you do when no one is looking or grading or judging you and, you know, sort of developing that. So I feel like I work on that with them. And I think the biggest parent thing I've learned is more is taught than caught.
Okay.
I'm sorry. No, more is caught than taught. Oh, my bad. More is caught than taught. So like you can talk their ears off, but you have to lead by example. So I train, I work out, I work hard, but then I try to spend time with them and just kind of lead by example. And I fail at times for sure. And they get me on that, but yeah, more is caught than taught.
I like that. It's really good advice. Okay. What is the best book you've read in the past year?
You know, I do a lot of driving. And so I listen to a lot of books and I read a few books. The only thing that comes to mind that a lot of good books, but Bill Bryson is a great author in The Sunburnt Country about Australia. It's a really good listen. Just kind of, you know, all the self-help books and everything about like your life transition sometimes can be, you know, they're great, but just can exhaust you a little bit. And to take your mind away, just learning about the history of Australia and the nuances of Australia were so cool. The way he paints the picture of that country, can't wait to go there someday, but I don't know. That's a good listen.
Nice. Add that to my Audible list right now. You also mentioned the neurosurgeon Marsh, Henry Marsh.
Oh, he's got some great books. And The English Surgeon is a really, I think it's an older documentary about him going to Ukraine and dealing with complex patients. That was just, he's awesome. He's sort of like a stodgy old English guy with sort of a quirky personality. But he's got a couple of books, Do No Harm and Admission, which are great reads. Yeah, I really liked that.
Sorry, I need to pick a tooth here, but which forceps do you use to extract, I don't know, let's say tooth number 12?
You know, I've switched and, you know, having done, I don't know, over 20,000 sets of wisdom teeth and 9 billion teeth, I feel like I still can learn on that stuff. You know, there's things that I've learned. Some people, you know, when we talk to buddies, you're like, whoa, you laid that little flap, or whoa. So I've switched over the last couple of years. So Ash.
Okay.
I used to call it the crown fracture forcep and I hate it. At times I would just throw it out the window. And now the Ash and I have become one. You know, I've just learned. You know, exodontia is a two-handed sport, you know, and I've learned to sort of like put my, you know, my forefinger in the right spot on the opposite hand. And we've just sort of, we've had a tumultuous relationship, the Ash and I, but we're definitely in a honeymoon right now. We're having a good time. So Ash for everything other than a molar, and then cow horns, 88R or the upper 88RL for uppers, and just cow horn for bottom. And then sometimes I'll throw in I call it a Goldie, you know, this little, I'm forgetting the name of it, you know, non-cowhorn molar force. Ash for everything and then cowhorns.
Oh, that makes me happy because I love the ash. I use the ash so much. And I feel like if you use it right and you're careful with it, it can just be such an awesome instrument that speeds things up for you.
Yeah. And, you know, I've had to learn because when I go to Guatemala, I set up these little exodontia shops in like these hills, the Mayans, we'll put them on chairs and we have like a pressure cooker that we're sterilizing things. And I can only bring so much stuff, you know, so I just bring a fistful of ashes and some cow horns and straight elevator. I'm good to go. Yeah.
Is there a particular ash that you like, or where do you get yours from?
I use the one that my assistant hands me.
Okay. Got it.
These things are probably like 30 years old. I don't know. They were just in the set at Dartmouth. And I never ordered anything.
Got it.
And I kind of adapt to, you know, there's a thin one that I never use. And I just, I don't know that, yeah, they're just old, and I just adapt to whatever's given to me.
Okay. I've used just tons of different kinds, and I've gotten picky, but the KLS makes one called the MD3, and I just love it. It's such a great...
Really?
They just like, I feel like they perfected the ash. Like it's awesome. Super nice.
Oh, okay. I'll have to check that out. Thanks.
Yeah, no problem. Next question. Do you have a favorite movie? Are you a movie watcher?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. The problem is we speak German in our household, and my wife is a real stickler with only watching movies that have, you know, German involved with them.
Okay.
And my girls are pretty particular, so we watch a lot of things that I don't like to watch, you know, and in German. So I haven't really watched anything lately.
So most of these movies are like in German. That's just the full movie is in German.
Yeah. So, but we watch a lot of movies that have been dubbed. So we watched Good Will Hunting in German. Yeah. Nice. Just recently. And I always loved that movie.
Yes.
So, but it's kind of fun.
So good.
And the Karate Kid in German with nice. wax off in German is kind of a funny saying in our house.
How do you say that in German?
Aufpoloren.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah. Good Will Hunting.
Well, I have to ask, if you watched and you like the Karate Kid, have you watched Cobra Kai?
You know, I have that on my Netflix deal. I haven't. Is it good?
Oh, I love it. It's so great.
Oh, nice. All right. I'll have to pull the trigger on that.
Yeah, I think it's really well done. I know some people while listening to this probably think it's stupid, but I just love the dynamics between Johnny and Daniel-san, you know, now that they're older and they have kids and they're still kind of fighting, but then they kind of, you know, learn to love each other. It's such a great show. Gosh, I love it.
Yeah, I'll have to check it out.
That's awesome. All right. And then quote, you mentioned maybe some quotes from Henry Marsh, but what is your favorite quote, or do you have a couple of them?
Yeah. I had recently, my oldest daughter just went to college, so I made her a little book, and we've always shared quotes. So this is on the tip of my tongue. We've just our favorite quotes, but I have two.
Okay.
I'll share with you. One is from like a reverend at our old, retired or reverend from our church that we go to. He says, Reverend Briggs, I enjoy the responsibilities, the appointments of a useful life. It was very, very meaningful for me in terms of the things we do, our career choices, what we do with our time, you know, being useful.
Yes, I like that.
Something we always, you know, at least I strive to be useful and have a purpose.
Yep, same here.
And, you know, I'm real intentional about it. And then the other quote is from Henry Marsh again. And this, I don't think you written it. It's just was at the end, I think it's the end of the documentary, he says it, which is really poignant to me. He says, what are we if we can't help people? Nothing at all. And so I think that just defines, you know, what we're doing. I mean, we're helping people. And not to get lost in that, because, you know, with high volume stuff we do in our office, I feel like we can get sort of lost in that. But then sitting down, every patient's an individual. Every patient's there for you to help them. And regardless of the quirks that they bring, you have to sort of sit back and go, you know, I'm here to help you, not help everyone, just you at the time. So I felt like that was poignant.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Really, really cool. That reminds me of a quote, so I have to piggyback on that one. But there's this crazy old dentist named Howard Ferrand. I don't know if you've heard about him, but he's put out a couple books on Audible, Dentistry Uncensored, and he kind of talks about how to make a successful dental practice. And he's actually the most prolific like general dentistry podcaster in the world. He's got like thousands and thousands of podcasts. And I was on his podcast. And
oh, cool.
He's just this crazy old dude from Arizona who likes to shoot off at the mouth and say wacky stuff. And one of his books, I really liked it. He was talking about the psychology that goes into, you know, a doctor and an employee and how you get good employees and, you know, and how much responsibility you give to your assistants and your staff. And at one point, I don't know the quote exactly, but he said, you know, a lot of people have this misconception that we're all striving for happiness and we all want to be happy. And there's some state of happiness that we all want to be in. And he basically said, you know, that's a bunch of nonsense. We don't want to be happy. We want to be useful. You know, we want to be productive and feel like we hold some type of meaning in the system that we're in. And that, like, if we were taken out of the system, out of our job, out of our, you know, family situation, that we would be missed because we contribute in some way to that, the progress of the group that we're part of.
Yeah.
And I just felt like that was so true, you know, that so many of us really want to be meaningful and useful, like you're saying in these quotes. It's really true.
Yeah. That's good. It's very well said. I think happiness is like a cat, you know. I think you just can't force a cat on a pet, but when you're sitting there and it curls up on you and you're able to just sit there and purrs, and it just comes and goes and you have really no control over it. And I feel like the avenue and happiness will come more frequently is if you have some purpose and, you know, are useful.
Yes, totally.
Happiness is a byproduct of that.
Yeah. And so part of life, I feel like, is figuring out how to be useful, but then also how to help other people be useful themselves and feel useful. For example, your kids, not doing everything for them, but helping them to get skills and things that make them feel useful, and contributing towards society and things is a important thing to do for them.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're doing that with taking your kids on mission trips. That's pretty awesome that you're doing that.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
I like that. Well, good. Thank you for taking the time this morning, Eric. I've thoroughly enjoyed talking with you and hope everything goes well with you.
Yeah. Appreciate it, Grant. And thanks for doing this podcast. It's really cool. I'm glad we have a nice oral surgery podcast to dive into and geek out on. It's great.
Totally. If there are listeners that have further questions or kind of want to contact you, are you okay with them reaching out to you directly, or would you prefer they contact me first?
Yeah, no, you can list my email there for sure.
Okay. Sounds good. All right. Well, I appreciate it and have a good rest of the day.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
Okay. Talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. Once again, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com if you have any topics you'd like to hear about, guests you'd like to hear from, or if you yourself would love to be a guest, please, please email me or text me at 720-441-6059. I'd also just love hearing from people if you enjoy the podcast or, you know, learn something from it or talk to a friend or connected with someone because of the podcast. That just makes my day. So please shoot that correspondence over to me, and I will see you on the next episode. Thank you.